Hello, I'm Lucy Ashton from Internet of Business, and today I'm joined by Ben Wold, founder of Berry, an IoT development agency that delivers end-to-end IoT solutions for its customers. As the founder and head of client strategy at Berry, Ben has helped lead over 250 product launches in the last decade. Ben guides Berry's growing team of more than 70 full-time engineers, designers, and data scientists in understanding clients' challenges and building custom IoT solutions. With IoT projects still rarely sticking to time plans, and in fact, 75% of IoT projects taking twice as long as planned, it is important to explore not only why this happens, causing financial and planning problems along the way, but also, of course, how it can be prevented. Therefore, today we explore the benefits agile development brings to IoT project delivery. We will gain insights into the key stages of agile development for IoT and look at the approach's positive outcomes. So I'd like to welcome Ben Wold now. Thanks, Ben, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So we're going to start with an easy question. Why do so many IoT projects take much longer than planned, or in fact, sadly fail? And how can this be changed?
Great question. It's a softball question. So IoT projects are tricky by nature. A lot trickier than if you were just building a software application or a mobile application. Much more tricky than if you just had to bring hardware through, you know, different design verification cycles and through, you know, getting various components certified and bringing it to market. You are pretty much packing all of the hardest things into one project, and they all need to end up working together seamlessly, and, you know, not creating gaping holes along the way that are either functional or, you know, security issues. So so many of them failed simply because you're pulling together so many different disciplines. At the end of the day, when we're talking about greenfield development, right, which is taking an idea and building something and bringing it to life and taking it to market, it requires people from many different backgrounds and disciplines to work together. And the important thing here is, can you create a system, an environment, protocols for people from, you know, different disciplines to work together and to ask questions at, you know, the earliest stages possible in development? And then ultimately, can you prevent people from getting thrown under the bus, right? So, you know, an example of this is, you know, designers, you know, design something that an engineer can't implement in the timeline or budget required. And you know, have a communication silo where maybe it's just the designer working with the client, you know, receiving business requirements. And you know, when they try to pass that over to the engineering team, you know, you hit a wall. Those are the types of silos that can really derail a project. And, you know, in terms of the communication that I'm talking about, the other thing to balance is simply the communication overhead, right? You can't have, it's not realistic to have every single, you know, mechanical engineer, electrical engineer, data scientist, software engineer, all in every single meeting, right? Because then you're on the other side of this, which is you have over communication, and it becomes extremely expensive. And so, long story short, this, you know, probably a more rambling answer, but if you can create a structure where people are communicating with each other at the right time, and if you can triage issues before you get too far down a particular path, you're going to have a much higher probability of success.
Makes a lot of sense. And why is Berry such a big advocate of agile development in particular? And can you give us a quick run through of the key steps you take to ensure project success?
Absolutely. So we are, every project that we do, we embrace you know, our version of agile, or kind of imbuing a project process with agility. And if, you know, if waterfall is on one end of the spectrum, and, you know, some like purist version of agile is on the other end of the spectrum, we're definitely somewhere in the middle, you know, but close to agile. And it's not that there's no planning. It's just simply planning at the right time. And so, you know, we are now having done, you know, goodness, 30 or so IoT projects this year. You know, we get a lot of cycles, and we get a lot of cycles figuring out what works and what doesn't work, and where there are pitfalls. And the thing that we've, you know, kind of really believe in is that an agile approach is going to be the best approach. Okay, so just to ground that a little bit, what process do we take when we're building an IoT project? So step one is we think through the validations and constraints. And that's just a process of going through what's been validated, what hasn't been validated, what are the constraints, what are the you know, security requirements, kind of laying all of that out. We then put together, and this is typically about a week or two cycle, is putting together a really detailed product or project development roadmap. And that is breaking everything down into individual cards, giving those cards a story point value, starting to really closely define, you know, what your epics are going to be. And we kind of embrace a methodology of adaptive planning. The next thing that we're going to do is work on some of the prerequisites from a hardware perspective. And I can get into this a little bit later about how we use a Volterra and how we can, you know, remotely print PCB boards without having to send, you know, those plans to a house that does it. But we can do that, you know, and rapidly iterate there. We then run through a handful of steps that are kind of taking what would be like a big prototyping phase and breaking it down into much smaller steps. And so that's going to be imitation, simulation, a microfacturing run, the first manufacturing run, a real manufacturing run. Now we're talking in the thousands, and then your go-to-market manufacturing run, and you know, the last step of the project is emulation with digital twin. And so, you know, again, happy to go into any of those individual steps, and I'm sure we've got some blog posts on our website that cover that as well. But in general, those are the different stages that we go through when doing greenfield development.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for the detail. And for those more skeptical of the agile development process, could you explain how you really ensure that you are building the right project requirements and building in stakeholder and customer feedback along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. So when one of the key reasons why we choose Agile over Waterfall is to build in a lot of cycles of putting prototypes, of putting different versions of the product in front of, you know, both clients and customers, and getting their feedback. And so to take a step back, when we start an IoT project with the client, image comes to mind of we're standing kind of at the beginning of a dark hallway, and we're, you know, there's a light at the end of this hallway. And if we were going to take a waterfall approach, it would be before we start walking down this hallway, we're going to like put as much detail as possible around this outcome. And even though we're a long way away from it, we're going to pretend that we can see it perfectly clearly. And then we're just going to start running at that thing, at that, like, you know, well-defined end goal. But the reality is that if you are planning too far ahead, you know, with 100% certainty, you're going to make mistakes along the way. And even if you hit it dead on the money, it's probably not going to have been the best product because you weren't factoring or refactoring learnings along the way. So what we think about is how can we turn the lights on a couple feet ahead of ourselves, right? A couple of steps ahead of ourselves. We want to be focused on just turning the lights on as we're going and making sure that we, you know, then aren't tripping down anything as we, you know, walk or crawl or walk or run down this dark hallway. So number one is that in terms of kind of refactoring feedback here. One of the things that we like to do is we want to build some small number of these devices and get them to do internal employee testing. So the employees of the company that's hiring us, we want to get 10 or 20, some number less than 50, typically, devices actually in the hands of people. And it doesn't have to be the final kind of fit and finish. You know, it can be 3D printed enclosures. And we, you know, so step one is getting employee field trials done. Step two in the process, and this is really, you know, potentially where you make your microfacturing run, is we're going to do early customer trials. Right. So we're actually going to send this. We're not going to charge anybody, but we're going to send some low number of hundreds of these devices out into the field, out with customers. And at that point, we want to have the at least the software infrastructure pretty well baked, ready to go. There can still be fit and finish and material choices on the hardware that can be made. But the main thing you're doing there is getting kind of external customer feedback and seeing where problems occur. The next step is what we would call like a pristine customer trial. Pristine customer trial, you know, you want to be, you're still probably definitely less than 5,000 units, probably less than 1,000 units. You're probably somewhere between 250 and 1,000 units that you're going to actually put in the field with customers. And this is where this thing should be ready to go. And at that point, you're looking for final validation. Along the way, you want to be collecting feedback and, you know, we could spend an hour talking about different methods and techniques for, you know, getting customer feedback and doing, setting up usability tests and so on and so forth. But assuming that you've got some good practices around that, there are steps built in along the way for you to be able to get a lot of feedback. And that's just kind of one of the core tenets of this, of the methodology, is enabling you to put product in people's hands as early as possible.
That's very cool. Very, very thorough indeed. And I'm sure there's a lot more that can be read on your blog. But which step do projects tend to start to slow down? And how does Ferry's agile process lessen that probability of holder or indeed failure?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. You know, and I'll answer it as like, where do things usually get hung up? Right. Mm-hmm. And there are gotchas in, you know, within every work stream. You know, there are places where, you know, software QA can break down and so on and so forth. But from what we've seen, a lot of those are mitigatable. But where things you typically have trouble in a project like this is going to be hardware turnaround times is typically the thing that, like, if you have to throw on the brakes, you know, it's because we were expecting a delivery of something and it just got pushed out a couple weeks and, you know, and we're starting to really wrench the system. You know, so I would say where projects start to slow down is in the early stages of hardware prototyping. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hardware is tough, right? It's tough and it's usually structured in a waterfall methodology because the hardware team needs to produce encompassing designs that get sent to, you know, a fabrication house, that then need to be assembled. And, you know, if you are going through kind of a waterfall process, you are left with a product, you know, and a board with maximum levels of uncertainty. Right. So let's say we've got a device that has, you know, some type of a display, a real-time clock. It's got a camera. You know, it's got all of these different pieces. You know, in the early stages, you know, you can have the hardware team working with firmware on, you know, component selection. And that is kind of an important feedback loop to make sure that you are choosing the right component. But then where things can break down is when you need to start ordering boards or ordering components to test. And so one of the things that we do is that we have our hardware teams have Volterra or Volterra devices is kind of the Volterra ecosystem we've been really enjoying. And that allows us to print custom boards on demand. And so, you know, let's say that in a typical process, if we wanted to get a board fabricated, we're talking about, you know, 2 to 3 days of production time, 2 to 5 days of shipping time, sometimes more recently. And in that amount of time using a Volterra, we could be printing and testing and cycling and have like many versions of our prototype, you know, just in that window. And so when we're able to have machines that can on-demand print boards for our hardware teams, it allows us to start to do the debugging of all the peripherals and starting to write and test, you know, different components much more iteratively and much quicker. And so long story short, hardware, from our experience, early stages of hardware development and prototyping are really where the timelines can get gummed up. And our solution for that has been to enable the internal capability to print and prototype boards. That's kind of been the game-changing thing for us. And then you can really move forward with a lot of agility between your embedded team, your software team, your hardware team, you know, both mechanical and electrical engineering.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Ben. And just one final question, because you've mentioned digital twins in your descriptions. So what do you see the role of the digital twin in IoT product development being going forward?
Great question. And this is, you know, digital twin, you know, definitely gets caught in the buzzword bingo of being, you know, something that it's like AI, you know, like our device uses AI. It's something that, you know, shows up in investor decks, but it sometimes doesn't really land anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so but with that in mind, we actually feel that it's a really important step. And so just to take a step back, what's a digital twin? What we're talking about is building a virtual replica, which is a virtual replica of the physical device, you know, and then connecting that virtual replica to, you know, the software infrastructure or a version of the software infrastructure that's running it. You know, this is going to be you building a model that is intended to emulate how this product should act, right? So your step one of building a digital twin is just creating a carbon copy, virtual carbon copy, you know, with all the known assumptions today. With that said, and that can sometimes be expensive, and so then the question is, you know, how do you get the return on investment with this, right? And this is where I think you can kind of land on the value of digital twins, is that the most important learnings are going to be when you actually deploy this device, you know, to the real world, and it gets dinged up, it has real, you know, human use, or it's being deployed, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa or a location that has, you know, extreme climate somewhere, right? And, you know, you can do a whole lot of testing in a QA lab, and that's probably the parameters that you're using when you're building the digital twin. But if you have a digital twin, you can then update that digital twin with the variables that you're seeing from the real world. And that's the important piece, is that if you don't have a model to begin with, you don't have a model to plug in new variables that you learn from when your product is deployed out in the field. And it's those new variables and those adjustments that you want to factor into new product development, or, you know, product extension, or upgrading different internal components, or, you know, making wiring changes or enclosure changes. It is how you are factoring in, you know, the kind of real world feedback. And we think that if you invest, you know, towards the upfront, quote unquote, but towards the end of the project in building a digital twin, then you've got a model that you can update with these new learnings. And that ultimately has huge ROI in terms of where you're extending the product or, you know, new versions of it.
Great. It's always good to dive a little deeper into these buzzwords. So that was really great insight. Well, thank you very much for your time, Ben, and we look forward to reading more about Very's work and insights, your views on your blog and at the Internet of Manufacturing event. Just before we leave, have you got any closing words of wisdom for our audience?
Closing words of wisdom. All right, let's see. I would say that there's no time like right now to work through the kinks of remote work and taking teams that have gotten used to the crutches of sharing space and being in one room and having like one physical whiteboard, there's no better time, you know, based on what's happening in the world, based on COVID, and to commit to figuring out this remote thing. Mm-hmm. As a company, we've been remote now for 9 years. And so, the shift to remote hasn't had any impact on us at all. And you know, one of the hacks, like I was talking about earlier, is putting a Volterra, you know, on everybody's desk so that they can print their own boards. But, my one bit of wisdom is that, it is up to the company whether they want to embrace and invest and make remote work awesome, or if they want to make it an awful experience for everybody and force everybody to go back to the office at some point. That's the company's decision. That's the decision that needs to come from leadership. And you know, again, we could talk a lot longer about where to invest and how to invest, and how to create and invest in culture, remotely. But, I think that if you can make that jump and you can work through the kinks now, there are huge, you know, long-term upsides to figuring it out. So there we go. That's my bit of wisdom.
That's great. Well, that was awesome wisdom. And we think Barry's awesome. So we look forward to hearing more from you. Thank you very much for your time today again.
Awesome. Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks, Ben.